The unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So today's Dogen Day, our festival of great Master Dogen, who, as many of us know, is the founder of our tradition of Soto Zen. He was Japanese, went to China to find the Dharma and came back to Japan, taught people. He was born into the aristocracy, and at his time, there were terrible feuds going on. His family was always at war with other families. His mother died when he was a child. And he was at a funeral and watching the smoke rising from the incense. And he had a deep realization of impermanence. Nothing lasts, everything changes. And this changed his whole life, that realization of impermanence. Now today is also the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in 2001. And once again, we have impermanence. In a moment, our whole world changed. And we can barely remember almost how it was before that, when you'd get on a plane and wouldn't think about, you know, terrorism or being searched by people and this kind of thing. It completely changed our world in a huge number of ways. Here in this country, abroad, there's been strife and trouble ever since. But maybe it's always been this way. You know, there's always been impermanence, always been sudden, awful things happening. Tsunamis, earthquakes, volcanoes, all kinds of things can happen to people, both on a small scale and on a global scale. And 9/11 is deeply meaningful to us because it happened on our own ground, as it were, you know, and so many things happen elsewhere. And we don't see them quite as clearly because they're somewhere else, happening to other people. But something happens to our own country, we think, whoa, you know. And it's always like this. We always see what's close to us more clearly, more vividly. And people somewhere else would see what happens to them. Massive earthquakes in China, Nepal, you know. Terrible death, Italy, not so long ago. Terrible devastation of people. These things can happen in just a moment. Constant impermanence. And great Master Dogen's answer was to go and seek for the truth. What does this all mean? What is it that actually I can rely on? What is true? This morning I was thinking about what to talk about, and what came up for me was restraint. Restraint when we feel impelled to do something immediate. Right after 9/11, the first impulse was for people to help each other. People helped those who were trapped, injured, bereaved. That was the first instinct, to help beings. And then there was this massive grief about what had happened. And it was after that that people began to get angry and want to blame somebody and so forth. But the first instinct was one of unity, helping beings, not divisiveness. And that was a really wonderful thing, if we remember how it was then, that coming together of the country, and other countries too in sympathy, this awful thing has happened. How can we help? And only later did the divisive aspect come in. So where's restraint in this? Restraining our divisive impulses, as it were. The impulses that divide us from other beings and divide us from ourselves. There's a lovely documentary called In the Footsteps of the Buddha. And an ancient monk, I think it's Ananda Maitreya, is talking about how to look at a Buddha statue. And he says, look at this statue. still, you know, showing restraint of eye, restraint of mind, restraint of speech, restraint of ear, restraint of body. Just all these forms of restraint, the refraining from looking outwards, from doing, from, you know, our attention going somewhere else. And of course, in meditation, this is what we try to do, to restrain. We're not looking around the room, sitting with our eyes cast downwards, not moving around, if you can help it, sitting still, not paying attention to what we hear, letting it come and go, but not clinging on to it. Restraint of mind, the hardest thing, to relinquish the thoughts that come and go, just letting them go through, not holding on to them, not pushing them away, the endless distractions of the mind. And that's what we try to do when we sit. But there's, of course, restraint in all the other aspects of our life, too. Restraining our selfish impulses. Restraint is not passivity, it's a dynamic thing, because it's quite hard to practice. It's like the riding the dragon we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. You're constantly riding that self that wants to, or the body that wants to get up and do something else, or rush off and do something. To restrain is a continual activity. It's not just, you know, doing nothing at all. Nothing flaccid about restraint. We're not cutting ourselves off from other beings. On the contrary, it helps us to be more with other beings, because we're training our selfishness, is what it is. Restraint is training of the self. Now, one thing about restraint is that when we're restraining ourselves, other people don't tend to notice, because we're not doing something. It's not obvious, and this tends to be feel a little unrewarding at first. Nobody notices, you know, when we don't get upset and say the unkind thing. Oh, she wasn't mean to me, you know. Or when we don't leap forward to show off the thing we can do, now I have the opportunity. Or insist on our opinion, or grab at something, you know. Nobody else may notice, but we notice. Especially when we have to work at it hard. You might think, I didn't bite back, you know, I didn't say the unkind thing, I didn't grab the thing, I kept my view to myself for once, you know. I didn't leap to my own defense and blame somebody else. And this doesn't look like much, but we may notice that actually we're practicing restraint, and we're getting better at it, because it's practice, 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 we keep doing it. And we see that we actually feel much better when we don't grab the thing, squeeze the life out of it, and then leave a little, you know, you grab something, you can't enjoy it because the life has been squozen out of it. Or, you know, say the unkind thing. We see, feel so awful when we don't restrain and we do something that's not right. The precepts, you know, it's restraint to keep to the precepts. Is to practice restraint, to refrain from taking something or saying something that's not quite true, or in indulging in harmful sexuality, or being unkind about somebody. Some of this seems completely obvious. We're not going to go around killing people and stealing stuff, generally. And we don't even think about it. But there's a little subtle ways in which we deprive somebody of something. We cut them off as they're right in the middle of their story. Or we put somebody down just a little bit, you know. Or just in little ways to speak against somebody else or to do something just a little bit unkind. And if we're noticing, we see these things and we have to refine our restraint. It's not just a matter of not killing insects and all this. It's not cutting something off, not belittling somebody, not being a little bit mean or a little bit grabby, pinching something, nobody's looking, you know. It's not a stealing thing, it's more a matter of just a sort of subtle, this isn't quite right, I don't feel quite good about it, you know. And And again, mostly people don't notice because we're not leaving a big wake behind us to keep. Enlightened action leaves no trace if we're really keeping to the precepts as best we can. People don't notice, generally, you know. Oh, that person was good for you, you didn't do the thing. And occasionally we might say, you know that somebody has a tendency and they didn't do it. And we might say, good for you, you didn't do that. But by and large, we may not notice. Others may not notice when we keep to the precepts, when we restrain our impulses. And as we go on, we always still have precepts we struggle with. None of us is perfect, you know. But still, we're working on it. Restraint is liberating. It's, yes, it's holding back, but it's also frees us from that endless compulsion to selfishness. The precepts are called the great liberators because they free us from having to be a me. There's this story of monkey, you know, the Tripitaka, the old Chinese story of monkey who's always wanting something, he's very clever and he wants this and that and the other thing. And he's given Kanzion, of Avalokiteshvara, out of a vast compassion, gives him the precepts, and there are a band round his head. And every time he breaks a precept, the band tightens, and his head hurts like mad, terrible headache. And then he thinks, oh, okay, you know, keep the precepts. And it kind of feels like that at first when you take the precepts. It's like a, you know, oh, God, I got to, oh, I can't do this anymore, okay. But then the band loosens a bit because it doesn't hurt anymore. We're used to it. We want to keep the precepts. The restriction is no longer a penance. Actually, we're grateful because it helps us to refrain from creating suffering. Wonderful. We can change. We don't have to act on our fears and desires and so forth. We don't have to be a big self. Because the problem, of course, is being a big self. Whatever it is we're doing, it can seem completely harmless. But if we're being a big self about it, it's a suffering in the end because we get sort of trapped by that selfness, having to be a me, having to have the last word or show off or say the witty thing that's a little bit unkind, you know, to be able to put it down, let it go, being the person who knows everything, who knows how to do everything. We can restrain. I don't have to do that. I don't have to be the one who tells everybody else how to do everything. Even if, of course, they won't do it perfectly, but, you know, they have to learn somehow. It's a delusion that they're the only one. If you want something done, well, do it yourself, you know. Deluded. Not having to be somebody, to be especially wise or especially clever or especially competent. Not having to compete with other people. Sometimes hard to do. You know, in the workplace it can be really hard not to compete. You can feel kind of pushed aside, ground underfoot and all that. But actually, there's a strength in it. A strength in not falling into that competitiveness. Because competition is always at the expense of somebody else. If I win, somebody else loses. Is that really happy making, you know? If I have to look good and do it better than anybody else, if I have to be the one with all the answers, well, what about everybody else? You know, how can anybody else figure things out if I have to do it for them, if I have to be the one who always knows? Can I not just leave other people to figure it out for themselves or let them live their life without having to tell them how to do it? I may have the best of intentions, but if I have to be in charge of everything, how can I, you know, let other people do things? It's actually belittling, inadvertently belittling people if I have to be in charge all the time, or always tell other people how to do everything. Let them shine too. Let people learn. Let them give their own gift. This doesn't mean we have to creep off into mediocrity. I can't do anything, you know. Because everybody has their talents and their gifts, including us, including other people. So we can make our best effort. Of course we do our best when we're at work or when we're doing something. But we don't have to be a big self about it. Just to do our best and let it go. We don't have to carry it around with us, because that's what creates problems. Just doing our best and then leaving it be, fine. But to kind of think, oh, I did really well at that. Did you see how I did that? It was really good. Or, oh God, that was so awful. Oh no, I did so badly. Oh no. Because just as bad the other way, you know, being a big self that's failed horribly is the same as being a big self that's greatly successful. It's still being a big self, instead of just being a normal person who can do some things better than others and other things not so well. Restraint of this great self that gets invested in everything we do, everything we can do, everything we say, you know, and all this. Back to our Buddha statue. Not just in meditation, but in daily life, this restraint of I, restraint of I, not always looking around at what we want. Ooh, look at that. Ooh. Going into the, you know, going into the internet actually and looking at everything. Having to look at 35 different versions of the same thing to see which one we want. You know, spending hours shopping to save 25 cents. Is my life really that cheap? Or just looking around all the time, but, you know, just looking around at what we want. Ooh, look at that person over there. Ooh, look what they're wearing, you know. Just to kind of, yes, it's nice to see, to be aware of our world, aware of what's going on, but not to be always looking out for something, looking out for something else. Feeding our desires, looking for the things that attract us. Restraint of ear, not getting all caught up in what we hear about other people, or what we hear on the news, or what we read on the news, actually. In a way, it's the same thing. Feeding our views about, oh, look at that, they did it again. I don't believe it. I do believe it. Yes, they did it again. Yes, I knew they would. Or having to know everything about people, you know, all about everything, having to know everything about everybody. It's a grasping. We don't have to know everything. We don't have to know everything that's going on in our world or everything that's going on even close to us. We can actually let people live their life. We don't have to know everything. Or restraint of, you know, the grasping ear that loves to hear this, that, and the other thing. Music. I love music. I had to be really careful not to be pulled off into it because it's very intoxicating. Restraint of body. Not having to rush off and do all the things you might like to do. Fill our lives with, you know, let's go here, let's go there, let's do this, let's do that. But to consider, is this a good idea? Is it good to do? Is it at the expense of somebody else? If I do this thing, is it going to have some kind of not very good consequence? You know, to consider before you just rush off and do things. Is it good? You know, am I going to endanger myself by doing this thing? Or cause great inconvenience to somebody? Is it helpful? Yes, we can enjoy things, of course, and we can do things and live our life and have fun and all that kind of stuff. But to be mindful, aware of what we're doing, not just blindly rush about. Restraint of mind, not feeding our deluded views, seeing what the mind gets up to. This is what our main practice is, of course, seeing what the mind is up to and relinquishing. What am I doing? You know, what am I thinking? Look at that crabby little thought I'm having about this person. Look at irritability. Look at that. I got out of bed and I'm annoyed about everything. Look at that. And then we can let it go rather than just be carried off by our irritation. Oh, they're doing this. And then there's that person doing that. And, you know, Oh, look at it. This is my little crabby mind. Just let it go. Have a cup of tea. Put it down. Grabbing onto our cup of tea too. Just not getting caught up in all the stuff of our mind, which is a huge subject all in its own, but here we go. Restraint. It can look really dull, you know. No one's going to say, oh, how restrained you are. It's like, how patient you are. Oh, yes, how wonderful, you know. But it's liberating. It's liberating. Not having to do all that stuff, not having to be a big self. It's not boring. It doesn't mean we don't do anything. As I said, we don't have to creep off into mediocrity and lifelessness. But it's just not being dragged around by our wants, desires. Oh, look at this. Oh, let's do that. Oh, I want to be in a scene. Oh, I can do something. Oh, I have a view about that. Oh, I know what that is. Out of 10 times the desire to speak, let 9 go past. A massive practice of ascetic restraint, practically. The greatest asceticism. Not saying something when you really want to, when you know how to do this thing. I have a view about that. I know what to do. I know what needs to be doing. I know all about that thing. Do. Let it go by. And it's so refreshing when you just sometimes just think, I don't have to get into it. I can just keep, you know, I can sit quietly here. And maybe somebody else actually knows more about this than I do. How about that for an idea? We're not the most important thing in the universe. We're just one of many, many beings. The most important thing is exemplified by our Buddha statue. That towards which we turn, that stillness, is not just negative restraint. Of course not. It's the positive cultivation and nourishing of what's important. The true heart within, that from which we act and from which we live, nourishing that. As we restrain ourselves, we nourish that. When we're busy being a self and doing all this stuff, we become out of harmony with it. We separate ourselves from it somehow. There's me and all my stuff, and then there's everything else or everybody else. But if we can just restrain all that busyness of body and mind sometimes, not all the time, but, you know, restraining how we go about things, how we think of things, we nourish that inward heart. We're living more in harmony with that. And this is anything but dull, it's liberation. And thinking of the 9/11 attacks, when those people helped other beings, not, well, some people just ran away because they were terrified, and you would never blame someone for that, but those who were able to come and help, or some people would be afraid and then they'd turn back to help somebody else. Everybody was afraid, they must have been scared stiff, and yet people helped each other. Both then and later, acting from harmony, acting from unity, all one body, rather than this little me, I'm afraid, and being attacked by, you know, is what. Coming together, we are naturally endowed with great goodness and compassion. People rise to the occasion, help complete strangers, because we have this natural kindness, generosity and courage. There's a piece in the offertory for Dogen showing courage, constancy and integrity to all. By sitting still, by cultivating true wisdom, helping beings as the moment comes. It's not always an emergency. Most of the time it's just daily life. And still, there's always that opportunity to sit still, to see what's good to do and help from that, to trust this inmost heart, nurture it, sitting still in meditation, sitting still in the affairs of our lives, sitting still when some awful thing happens. What's good to do here? And letting it help our world, letting it help ourselves, the people we're close to, people we don't even know. No matter what happens, whether it's just normal, ordinary daily life or some crisis, some huge event, we can do this. We can entrust ourselves to that important thing, that which is within all of us. Entrust ourselves to that and let it guide us. That's restraint, not just rushing off. Sometimes it's completely instinctive. We don't even think about it. Grabbing somebody in the street when they're about to get hit by a bus or something. You don't even think about it. And yet we're still acting from that wisdom. And most of the time, it's more stillness, waiting, giving ourselves a little moment before we rush off and do something or say something that we might regret. Stillness within this moment right now, and allowing that to help us and help those whom we are trying to help. And we can do it. So here we are, it's Dogen Day. It's the 15th anniversary of 9/11. And somehow it all seems to come together. There is impermanence. Everything changes. And within all that, there is that which does not change, on which we rely, that which supports everything. And that's what we come back to. And that's our talk for today. Thank you.